even doing it equitably this time around isn't going to be good enough because we need to actually make up for how inequitable it was last time around.
Hi, I'm Jim Doyle, president of Business Forward, and you're listening to the Business Forward podcast. Business Forward helps local business leaders fix Washington by bringing Washington to them. Subscribe to our podcast to hear conversations with policy experts, elected officials, and business leaders about important issues like climate action and affordable healthcare.
In this episode, our network briefed Biden officials on the American Rescue Plan. Biden's director of the White House Office of Public Engagement, Congressman Cedric Richmond, joined us for introductory remarks. And Bharat Ramamurthy, deputy director of the National Economic Council, answered questions from business leaders on economic recovery, equity components, and PPP loans. This briefing was a part of a series of briefings Business Forward and our partner, Small Business for America's Future, will conduct with Biden officials on critical economic, climate, and healthcare posts. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Well, hello, everyone. My name is Rhett Buttle with Small Business for America's Future. Jim Doyle and the Business Forward team and I are so pleased to host today's conversation. Our series of briefings with members of the President's administration give small business leaders like you a seat at the table to share what's most important to you, and we're so glad that so many of you have been able to join us today. We also want to thank so many of the local and state organizations, chambers of commerce, for inviting their members. I know today we're so proud to partner with the Small Business Majority, the U.S. Hispanic Chamber, the South Carolina Small Business Chamber, the U.S. Black Chamber, and AAPI chambers across the country to make today's conversation possible. Congressman Cedric Richmond, who is senior advisor to the president, will kick off today's conversation. We're also going to hear from Bharat Ramamurthy, who's the deputy director of the National Economic Council. We're so pleased to have these two gentlemen with us to discuss the American Rescue Plan, its effect on small business, and how small business community can help support this critical package that we know is needed. The Congressman and Bharat, we're so pleased to have you with us today. And with that, it's my pleasure to turn the conversation over to Congressman Richmond, senior advisor to the president. Please take it away.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I don't want to take up too much time. I want to be respectful of everybody's time, but I just want to reiterate how important the American Rescue Plan is to the economy and to the country. It's important. It's bipartisan. It has strong support from Republicans and Democrats and overwhelming support. And so what we're trying to do, and I know people have heard me say this before, we didn't just pick $1.9 trillion out of the clean air. What we did was we looked at every component of the economy and of people's lives where COVID is wreaking havoc. And then we set to figure out a solution to each and every problem. And at the end of the day, we added it all up and it added up to $1.9 trillion. And we have $20 billion in there for veterans because we don't want to leave veterans behind or leave veterans out. We have $130 billion in there so that we can open up schools and get people back to work. And so if you just look at all of the proposals we have in there, we have unemployment insurance at $400 a week enhanced because we know that there's 11 million Americans that are without work through no fault of their own. We give $350 billion to state and local governments so that they can do a number of things. But one, help their frontline workers, police and firefighters and other people who are on the front lines, but also some states may choose to create programs for small businesses to help out their local small businesses because they know better than the federal government in terms of what they need and what's out there. Also, the big part of it is the $1,400 that we're going to send to every American who needs it. And look, we know that this pandemic has hit the pocketbooks of many hardworking people, and we want to make sure that we give it to those people that need it. And we're going to keep the middle class included in this because we think that at the end of this pandemic, there are going to be things coming due and they're going to need that money also. And so that's our thinking around the American Rescue Plan. The leading economists for the last four presidents have all endorsed it and said how it's needed. Moody's has said that with the American Rescue Plan, we can get back to full employment by the end of the year. CBO said that without it, it would take an additional 4 years to get back to full employment. And so that is a great summary of how important it is. And then the last thing I'll say is that Moody's also found that passing it would create 7.5 million jobs this year. So why it's important to our small businesses, because we know our small businesses are the backbone of this country. And small businesses rely very heavily on the communities that they serve. And if the communities are hurting, the small business is hurting. And we know that we can't get back to full employment and we can't get the economy going without helping our small businesses, which is why we made the changes to the Paycheck Protection Program and other things that we're doing. So we really just want our small business community to rally around the ARP and push people to support it. And look, it is bipartisan. We have local Republican mayors and governors. It's bipartisan everywhere except in the halls of Congress. And so to the extent that you can help us with that, we absolutely want this bill to have Democratic and Republican support. And so if you can help us get Republican support, we want it. And you saw us meet with 10 Republicans to exchange ideas. We laid out our plan, they laid out their plan. But the one thing that has not happened yet is we asked them, who would you leave out of this plan? You say it's too big, so tell us who you would leave out. And we still don't have an answer to that. And we're not willing to leave Americans out there on their own. This pandemic and this economic crisis is a humongous problem. And unfortunately, because it's so big, it demands a big, costly solution. But we're going to stop chasing COVID-19. We're going to get in front of it. We're going to vaccinate this country. We're going to do it faster than any other country is doing it. And so with that, I'll just turn it back over. And again, thank you all for what you do. We hope that you are surviving in this economy, and we're here to help. So thank you again.
Well, Congressman, thank you so much for your time and your leadership. I now wanted to invite into the conversation Bharat from the NEC team. We'll hear from Bharat, and then we'll move into some question and answers from folks on the line. So over to you, Bharat.
Thanks, Rhett, and thanks everyone for joining us today. I just want to build quickly on what the Congressman said, but do it quickly so that we have plenty of time for questions. You know, you look at what's been happening with jobs over the last 3 months, and the trend is pretty flat. In other words, job growth is starting to stall out, and it's stalling out at a level where we're 10 million jobs short of where we were pre-pandemic. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office projected that without further action, it would take us 4 years to get back to that pre-pandemic unemployment level. And that means 4 years of too many people being out of work, businesses continuing to shut down, and the economy not running at full speed. And so that just underlines the need for big, bold action along the lines of the American Rescue Plan. Moody's, which is, a Wall Street independent firm, analyzed the American Rescue Plan and found that it gets us 7 million jobs back just this year. It gets us back to that pre-pandemic unemployment level next year instead of 4 years from now. And that just means it's going to do so much for the economy, and it's going to improve so many people's lives. Quickly to tick through the components of it, a big part of it is money for vaccines and testing, which are in many ways the key to get the economy back up and running fully again. Getting shots in people's arms as quickly as possible, that's critically important, but it's also a huge undertaking, and it requires a lot of resources at both the federal and state and local level to get that done quickly and equitably. Second, there's a significant amount of money for reopening our schools, doing it quickly, but also doing it safely for kids, safely for teachers as well. There's a lot of direct relief for families, because there's a lot of families that are struggling. You know, just the other month, the Fed said that, according to their survey, 1 in 7 families in the country are experiencing hunger. 1 in 7. 7 million people are behind on their rent right now and are facing potential eviction unless they can cover that shortfall. As you know, millions of people are still unemployed, and we've already lost about 400,000 small businesses. And those are small businesses that people poured their heart and soul into and were the backbone of the communities that they operated in. And we want to make sure that we stop as many of those closures as we can going forward, and we give opportunities for people who may have lost that first small business to come back, rebuild, create a new business going forward. So I want to talk a little bit about what's in the American Rescue Plan specifically for small business at the moment. There's roughly $60 billion additional dollars in the American Rescue Plan. $15 billion of that is for grants directly to the hardest hit companies in low and moderate income communities. Those are companies that were, based on the data that we've seen, unfortunately left out from a lot of relief last year and into the beginning of this year, and they need particular support. Number two, there's $25 billion at the moment for restaurants and bars specifically. As you all know, that segment of the market has been hit particularly hard. The December jobs report showed that we lost 400,000 jobs just in that one part of the economy. And so a lot of direct support to small restaurants so that we don't lose these critical elements of our communities and a big source of employment. Number three, there is a bit of additional money for the PPP to accommodate in part some of the changes that have been made to the program this time around, which I'll get into in a little bit more detail. And then fourth and finally, and this is really important to the president, there's a $10 billion down payment on what he calls the Small Business Opportunity Fund. And the idea there is that we need to give relief to small businesses so that they can survive the next several months. But we also want to have a pot of money so that businesses that may have survived and hung on can actually start to grow coming out of the other side of the crisis. So it's working capital for businesses to expand, to bring back employees, you know, maybe to make that addition that they want to make, to expand the outdoor space, to make other changes to their business. And I think that that's going to be a critical part of making sure that we're letting the small business community not just survive the crisis, but thrive going forward. I also wanted to talk very quickly about the changes to the PPP that the administration announced earlier this week. Five big changes. Number one, an exclusive two-week window that actually started at 9 o'clock this morning, and that will run until March 9th, during which only businesses with under 20 employees can apply for PPP. That's about 98% of the businesses in the country are under 20 employees. But as you all know, it can be challenging for those small businesses to navigate the process. They need to understand what relief is available. They need to find a lender that's going to work with them. They may not have all the paperwork handy to get through the process. They may not have an accountant or a lawyer like some of the bigger businesses. And so we wanted to make sure that there was a period of time when both the SBA and all the lenders out there can really focus on helping these very small businesses, which have been left out of a lot of relief the first time around. Second, there was a major change in the way that we're going to be treating sole proprietors, which is a big chunk of the business community. Previously in PPP, the way that the amount of relief was calculated for sole proprietors meant that they were very, very limited in the amount of relief that they could get. And we went ahead and made a change where the amount of relief that they can get is based on the gross income in their tax filing, up to a cap of about $20,000, which will mean that, you know, the independent contractor, you know, the person who has a cleaning service, one person cleaning service, they can get some support through the PPP. Number three, there were a set of changes that were all about expanding access or eliminating restrictions that we felt didn't make sense. Number one, if you were anybody who was in default or delinquent on their federal student loans was ineligible to apply, we think that doesn't make a lot of sense, especially given the number of folks who are in default or delinquent right now. We got rid of that restriction, thinking that having a small business owner lose their business is not any way to ensure that they're going to help maybe pay off their federal student loan sometime in the future. Second, we clarified that all U.S. legal residents are eligible for the PPP, which is what Congress said it should be. And that includes people who file taxes using ITIN numbers rather than the Social Security number. And number three, in conjunction with a bipartisan bill in Congress, we eliminated a restriction that said that somebody who had committed a felony in the past, not a fraud-related felony, just a felony of any kind, was ineligible to apply for PPP. We think that if somebody had served their time, they're back owning a small business, they should be eligible to participate in the program just like anybody else. So we're excited about these changes. We think they're going to make a big difference. But part of what we want to do, and what I'm hoping to discuss today, is talk about how we can let people know about these changes. A lot of the hurdles that we face are, how do we make sure that five-person business on Main Street in a small town knows that PPP is available for them, that there's still plenty of money left to get help, and that there are resources available to help them fill out the paperwork, work with a lender, and actually get that money in the bank account, maybe save their business, keep people in their communities employed. So we can really use your help with that. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Great. Thank you so much for that. We'll launch right into our Q&A. Again, just want to say thank you to Congressman Richmond for joining us earlier. So let's start with economic recovery for small business. Kind of noted this with some of your first remarks, but I want to make sure that we drill down on some of these micro business questions that we received. I'm going to batch them so we can get through as many small business leader questions as possible. First question is from Ron Wax in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The second one is Mr. Al Lee. He's a transport service concierge in New Jersey. So the first question is, when will the administration recognize and assist U.S. micro businesses, the largest business demographic in the U.S.? And the second question is there a plan for micro businesses?
Great questions. I think the changes that I just discussed are in many ways designed to do exactly that, right? You have a huge proportion of small businesses are sole proprietors or non-employer firms, as they're called. And if you look at the data, there's a disproportionate number of them that are women and minority owned. Something like 70% of micro businesses or sole proprietors are women and minority owned, and that compares to 40% of employer firms. And so if you're systematically excluding those small businesses that sole proprietors, you know, that's going to have a disparate effect both across gender lines and across racial lines. It has been a core principle of this administration that we are going to be distributing relief more equitably than the previous round. And this change on sole proprietors is in part to do that. So just to get into the wonky details for a second, it used to be that if you're a sole proprietor, the amount of PPP that you were eligible to get was based on the net income on your Schedule C tax filing. You know, that deducts money for rent and for depreciation and for healthcare costs. And for a lot of sole proprietors, that number is very small. And there are instances of people applying and getting $8, right, which is not going to help you or your business very much. And of course, I think a lot of people looked at it and said, if I can get $8 or $10, what's the point of going through this whole process? We changed it so that instead it's based on your gross income instead of your net income. That way, you know, folks can get significantly more money, like I said, up to about $20,000, which we think is going to help a lot of these small businesses survive. And, you know, whether that's the cleaning service or the independent retailer who sells stuff over the internet, these are really important businesses and that help sort of the vibrancy of our economy. And it's a priority of ours to make sure that relief is getting to them too.
Completely agree. So let's go into some specifics on PPP as well. I'm going to batch two different groups. And, you know, if we need to go back to some of them, you let me know. But let's go first with the kind of the speed and delays of PPP. I have two questions. The first one is from Reva Minkoff. She's an entrepreneur in Chicago, Illinois. The second question is our friend Matt Haller here in D.C. First question is anything being done to accelerate PPP loan forgiveness process? The second is, we've heard that SBA is taking significantly longer to approve some PPP loans during the second round of the program. With the PPP program scheduled to close on March 31st, do you anticipate that every business that wants a PPP loan has applied for one, meets the eligibility test, able to get one?
Yeah, so on forgiveness, the answer is the SBA is dedicating a huge amount of resources to trying to get through the forgiveness process as quickly as possible. You know, we understand how important that is for both lenders and for small businesses to get that forgiveness. You know, it is obviously tricky because we are taking in and processing new applications at the same time as we're trying to work through the forgiveness process for companies that got previous rounds of assistance. I assure you that we are trying to do that as quickly as possible. And one of the things that I did not mention in my opening remarks about the American Rescue Plan is that there is a chunk of money in there for the SBA for administrative costs, right? In other words, to bring in staff, to get resources, to go through this even faster. So, you know, our hope is that if this bill is able to pass in the next couple of weeks, that money gets into the SBA, we can bring on more people to really help accelerate all of these things. In terms of applications, our view is that We have this 2-week exclusivity period right now for businesses under 20 employees. There is going to be a significant amount of money left in the program after that 2-week period ends on March 9th. So there'll be about 3 weeks with plenty of money left for businesses of any size to apply and get a PPP loan. There are some rules about, you know, if an application is submitted right before the deadline and it's not approved before March 31st, what happens? You know, those are set by law. It's not something that the SBA can deal with. So I would just encourage folks, get your application in as soon as you possibly can. And I think that what SBA has told me is that on average, it takes under 48 hours to process the typical application. So, you know, we would like to bring that down if we can. We understand that 48 hours matters a lot, but we are trying to work through them as quickly as possible while, and this is a core priority of the president, making sure that there is not fraud and waste and abuse in this program, that companies that are getting money are eligible for the money because he believes that each and every taxpayer dollar is valuable.
The next two still on PPP. The first one is from Robert Chester in Zephyr Cove, Nevada. Second one is from Kathy Dawkins. She's the founder of the Black Business Owners in Charlotte, North Carolina. First question from Robert is, what mechanisms are in place to ensure that individuals and businesses, entities not in need are unable to crowd out those that do need assistance? We may have touched on that, and this is from Kathy, with over 35% of Black and minority businesses being forced to close their doors, will there be an initiative to bring back those businesses? And can there be a task force, a commission, specifically for Black and minority businesses to assess their losses and somehow create a liaison between said businesses and the federal government?
Great questions. Let me start with the second one. As we noted, there are some really important disparities in how previous rounds of relief have gone out into the communities and how the design of those relief efforts systematically were providing less relief to Black minority-owned businesses in general, women-owned businesses. The steps that we have announced on Monday, I think, will help significantly. You know, Black-owned businesses are much more likely to be under 20 employees, so that exclusivity period will help. As I noted, the data on sole proprietors indicates that 95% of Black-owned businesses are sole providers. And so, you know, targeting relief to those types of companies is gonna be really important. Obviously, it's a separate point that there's a lot of businesses that unfortunately we were too late to save, and a lot of good business owners who didn't do anything wrong and who are good business people who lost their business and now are looking for another opportunity to do that because they're entrepreneurs. That's in part what that Small Business Opportunity Fund is about, right? It is a significant amount. It's about $10 billion in federal dollars, but it leverages private money. And so it's going to result, you know, between $50 and $100 billion is our hope in capital going out into communities with a particular interest in working with, you know, business owners who may have lost their business during the last year. So we understand that there's a lot of pain out there, and we really want to work with the business community, because if what we're doing isn't enough in a particular area, we want to know that. And we want to do what we can to try and fix it. You know, I just, an interesting story about all this, you know, the president has had a series of conversations with small business owners over the last few weeks. You may have seen them on the internet. And the changes that we announced on Monday in large part were driven by what he heard in those conversations, right? He heard from a small business owner down in Miami that she was able to get PPP because she's pretty sophisticated. She's got a few, you know, about a dozen locations. But the really small business owners that she works with didn't know how to navigate the process, couldn't get in the door with a lender and so on. And so, you know, when we announced these on Monday, the president called her back and basically said, you know, thanks for telling me about that. I went ahead and created this 2-week exclusivity period so that lenders would really have to focus on people like in your community. So anyway, it's just an example of how, starting with the president, the administration is very focused on hearing from business people about what's going on and trying to be responsive to that.
What a great story. Thank you to the president for doing that and making sure, and also you for making sure that avenue is accessible and there for small business leaders. So our next questions will go into a little bit of the equity piece. Again, going to group these two questions together. First question is Kathy Bennett with the Women's Veterans Business Solution in Maryland. Her question is, how do businesses ensure fair access to benefit from these resources? How can equality be part of the process? The next question is from Professor Bill Redman from Chicago, Illinois. And his question is specifically, what are the administration's plans to extend economic opportunities to women moving to C-levels and upper management positions?
Great. I think that there has been a lot of emphasis on equity in this administration. Right after the president was elected, he basically said that there's four pillars of what he wants to do. And one of them is about equity, racial equity, you know, addressing some of the systemic issues that our country has struggled with for a long time. And like as we've already discussed today, I think you see a lot of that in how small business relief has been administered before, you know, last year. Just to give a very simple example, you know, PPP obviously works through the existing financial system, right? It works with lenders. And of course, there's nothing nefarious about this, but lenders and banks want to work with their existing customers, right? Or they at least want to make sure that their existing customers are taken care of before they go out and try and find new customers that they can help with some of these small business relief programs. Well, you look at the rates at which, you know, a Black-owned business is likely to have a pre-existing relationship with a banker compared to other categories of businesses, it's pretty stark. And that means, again, setting up the program that way, you know, without any additional changes to make sure that those people were taken care of, the people without an existing bank relationship, meant that a lot of that money that went out the door quickly went to, you know, did not go to minority-owned businesses. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're trying to be aware of that. We're trying to make sure that relief is distributed equitably this time around. But I think it's important to note that even doing it equitably this time around isn't going to be good enough, because we need to actually make up for how inequitable it was last time around. So that's why we proposed things like the additional $15 billion in grants that are targeted at the very smallest companies, at companies that operate in low and moderate income communities, because we view that as a big hole in the relief efforts so far.
And the next question will go into kind of some labor and workforce. This is specifically on minimum wage. And this is from Amelia. She's an attorney and faith conference leader. Her question is, how can we develop a business model for increasing the minimum wage? Almost all arguments for increasing the minimum wage are morally or ethically based. Those arguments do not resonate with everyone, and our faith community needs to speak in financial or business terms to obtain a $15 minimum wage.
I definitely hear that. I think number one, you know, the president is absolutely committed to a $15 minimum wage, as he has said over and over again. And you're right, it does start for him with a, I don't know if you want to call it a moral point, but a fairness point, which is that nobody in this country should work 40 hours a week and live in poverty. And unfortunately, under the current minimum wage, that's the case for a lot of people. And it would not be the case with a $15 minimum wage. So, you know, that's an important point. But there are serious economic benefits to a higher minimum wage. You know, roughly 30 million people, 30 million workers, make under $15 an hour. Raising that to $15 an hour brings, I think, a million people out of poverty. It puts money into the pockets of people who are going to spend that money on clothes and groceries and rent and other basics. And they're going to spend that money in the communities in which they live. So it's going to be a boost to local communities. You know, the data on this suggests that, you know, other areas that have raised their minimum wage, including up to $15 an hour, the effect has been positive on the economy overall. There hasn't been a significant change in the amount of jobs that are available in those communities, but lower income people have more money in their pockets. That's good for the local economy. And so we believe that this is the right thing to do morally, but it's also the right thing to do economically. And just a final point, a lot of the people who would benefit from a $15 minimum wage are essential workers, right? They're the people who've been stocking the shelves, delivering the groceries, picking the crops, doing the things that are necessary to keep the economy going this whole time, and putting themselves at risk to do that. And the president believes that we should praise them, as we all do, but that we should also pay them. We should pay them more, because they're entitled to it. So that's our case for the minimum wage increase for $15 an hour. You know, a final point is just that all of these different proposals for $15 an hour, you don't snap your fingers and it's $15 an hour tomorrow. Right? There is a period of time during which it ramps up from the current federal minimum wage, which is only $7.25 an hour, up to 15. It's going to take, you know, a few years at least based on what the current proposal is in the House of Representatives bill. That will hopefully also give time for business owners to adapt rather than seeing a huge surge in increasing wages right away.
Thank you for answering that question. We're going to switch over to infrastructure next. And I know this is a favorite topic, especially when people talk about Infrastructure Week every other week, but would love to talk about, you know, the small business opportunity in this. And this question comes from Joe Reddick with the Reddick Group in Hanover, Maryland. Joe's question is, the Build Back Better strategy seems full of infrastructure opportunities for small businesses. Can you talk to the top three focus areas and how they may relate to small businesses?
Sure. I mean, look, the big picture point here is that better roads, better bridges, better power grid, all of these things are going to benefit the economy generally. And that's going to help big businesses and small businesses. It's going to be easier to ship your goods. It's going to be your stuff will arrive on time. You know, prices will go down in certain areas. All of that is very important for business owners of all sizes. You know, the Build Back Better plan that the president campaigned on, there's a significant amount of money for surface transportation, right? So fixing crumbling roads and bridges. There's a lot of money for housing, right? We have a significant affordable housing problem in the United States, especially for people who make $25,000, $30,000 a year. It's hard to find a place to rent that doesn't take up, you know, more than half of the income that they bring home. And the lack of affordable housing means that sometimes it's hard for business owners to find employees, right? One of the hard things about finding good employees for your company is that there's got to be an affordable place to live nearby. There's got to be a decent transit system, maybe, to make sure that those people can get to work. And there's also a significant amount of money in Build Back Better for improving transit. So it's all related to long-term investments that will fundamentally shift the way the U.S. economy works, right? We've neglected making these investments for a long time. The whole economy has suffered because of that. And if we take this opportunity to make these big investments, to put a lot of money into roads and bridges and our power grid and our housing stock, to bring back good manufacturing jobs to the United States, which, you know, is a big, there's a lot of small businesses that do manufacturing or that will benefit from having more domestic manufacturers. That's going to pay off in the short term with jobs. It's also going to pay off in the long term, right? One of the things I like to think about is in the 50s, the government made a huge investment in building a national highway system. If you look at it in terms of what that cost in today's dollars, it would blow you away, right? Trillions and trillions of dollars. But what did it do, right? It ended up connecting every different part of the country. It meant that a business owner who might live in a small town still had a way of getting their goods shipped to all over the country. And it fundamentally changed the way that the U.S. economy worked, right? And now we can't imagine what it's like to have a country or an economy where there aren't highways that get you from here to there. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that we need to do something like that. And that's sort of what the Build Back Better plan envisions.
We have a few more questions, but I want to give you an opportunity to provide any concluding remarks. Is there anything we missed? We want to make sure that these small businesses hear from the administration, from you.
Yeah, just a couple of quick things, and thank you again for this opportunity. Number one, small business is close to the president's heart. He really loves the idea that he thinks that it's something fundamentally American about people, you know, taking a risk, trying to start a business, supporting their communities, employing people that live in their hometown. And I think we would love to partner with you and the small business community to really understand what it is going to take to get through this crisis and then come out the other side and have a small business infrastructure in the United States that's even better than it was going into the pandemic. Number two, I would just ask, like I said, one of the biggest barriers to companies getting relief is that they don't know what's available and how to get it. So I would ask everyone on this call, take advantage of your local networks that you might have, business networks that you have, let people know about this two-week exclusivity period for really small businesses, let people know who may be sole proprietors that if they took a look at PPP before and gave up on it because it wasn't going to give them enough money, that there's going to be a change coming that would mean that they could actually get a real amount of money that can help them. Please let them know about that. And like I said, we hope that we can partner with everyone going forward, because you know, it's not just half of GDP that comes from small businesses and all of that data. It's about the character of American cities and towns. And that's something that's really important to the press.
Well, thank you so much. I know this is what we have time for today, but thank you so much for joining us. This is really important to make sure that Congress knows that the small business community does support this plan. Not only that, but what Bharat just said. We need to make sure that the small business community around us has the information that they need to access some of this new PPP information. Thank you again, and we will talk to you soon.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. For more information on Business Forward programming, visit businessfwd.org. The Business Forward podcast is a production of Business Forward, hosted by me, Jim Doyle. Produced and engineered by Alexi Lippman and Alex Pastanen. Special thanks to our Director of Programming, Jana Platt. Thanks for listening. See you next time.